So again, I'm not really focusing on the transactional decision, but trying to understand the adequacy of the liquidity based on the scenarios, and leave it to you guys to make whatever judgments there are. So, Carl, maybe next time we can talk a little bit more about your sense about the adequacy of the liquidity given these four scenarios on page 7 to help us understand whether we're planning for 2007 or 2008 again. I know everyone's saying, here come hard times.
I know.
Let's get ready.
And that concludes the report.
Thanks, Carl.
Thanks.
I love what you're able to do on here, so thank you. John.
Asset allocation and the NAV charts are section 8. And in terms of asset allocation, exception remains a little overweight to private equity as Ben and Mike Mueller build out the alternatives portfolio, which a couple of people have alluded to today. And then the NAV charts are going back in the right direction, which is good news. And then section 9 is the forward calendar, and I draw everybody's attention to the August OIC meeting date, which has been changed. Moved back a week from August 3rd to August 10th so that we could secure a quorum. And then in terms of agenda item number 10, I know staff's got some comments that they want to share before we go to public comments.
Great.
I think we're going to be a little bit of a wet blanket on that when rates normalize discussion. And we may add one risk factor to Jim Callan's that I think he was very eloquent on, and that is the negative interest rate phenomena in many central banks around the world. And we're starting to see some meaningful flows. Believe it or not, people don't like negative interest rates, and they're moving money around the world to avoid them. So our mission, and we've already accepted it, is in about 5 minutes to briefly talk about the landscape today of what is negative interest rate environment. A brief comparison of the German Bund curve, which is the U.S. Treasury equivalent in a very high-quality AAA euro-denominated curve. Compare that to the U.S. Treasury curve and explain why that might be meaningful for investors to leave that area and come to the U.S. And then we're going to show some flows that are indicating that they are doing exactly that. And then we're going to transition to Angela, and she's going to talk a little bit about what does that mean for us, both in terms of risk and opportunity. So I've been up here before, but just as a brief introduction, I'm Garrett Cudahy. I'm a fixed income investment officer at Treasury.
Angela Schaffers. I'm an investment analyst with the fixed income group.
So jumping right in, this is really colorful. It's pretty busy. But I really want to just focus your attention on that zero bound. And what this is showing from left to right is a progression over time of central bank policy rates in several key economies around the world. And they've gone into new levels of experimentation to spur inflation and growth. And that is they've gone below zero. And not only is the policy rate below zero, a lot of the cash rates and money market instruments are below zero. And it gets even better. We'll get to that. But the real impact is 25% of the world's GDP, all in dollar terms right now, is in a negative policy rate environment, or country, sorry. That's pretty meaningful, and historically, we've never seen it before, and I don't think there's any textbook model that really tells us what next. It's pretty early in these innings. The major economies, Japan and Europe, have only recently entered this foray, so we're now starting to see more meaningful flows we're going to touch on, and that's why, although you'll see some of these rates were negative in 2014, that's why we're talking about it today. It's becoming much more of an impact on us. So this, again, is colorful. On the left are countries' names, and on the top is term to maturity. And this is to represent different spots along these sovereign government curves. And red means negative yield. So, for example, Switzerland, this negative interest rate policy has bled its way all the way into the 10-year. In fact, Swiss government rates are negative to the 15-year spot on the curve, and they have a 50-year debt instrument outstanding that is yielding 24 basis points. That's a long, long bond. And it's not just constrained to government debt. 10% of the euro-denominated investment grade index is trading at a negative yield. The catch there is at least you probably get your money back. That's pretty good. So here's our comparison. On the top is the current U.S. Treasury curve. On the bottom in green is the German Bund curve, both for AAA and kind of bastions of safety in times of stress. Investors will flock to these markets. So they're pretty comparable in terms of risk or perceived risk. And the red dotted line is the zero bound. And on the bottom is the spread differential between these two. This is the 98th percentile in terms of spread differential between these two perceived similar risk countries. That's historically, again, unheard of. And it gives a lot of incentive, currencies aside, hedging aside, for investors to go ahead and leave that German market or these other euro-denominated or yen-denominated markets and come to the relatively high-yield U.S. Treasury market. So now we're getting a little bit more wonky, and I apologize for that, but it's important to the conversation. This is the euro area of balance of payments looking at net portfolio investment flows. And what this is really meant to show is that that red line going down are outflows in fixed income. People are taking their money and leaving. And that is just a very stark sign that they're just not wanting any of this. They're plenty willing to hand over these bonds to the ECB, who will buy them as part of their quantitative easing program at a negative rate. And they're going to go somewhere else. I think, and we noted here, an important implication is wherever they do go in search of better yield or better opportunity, are they renters or owners? That's important for volatility and future trends and investors like ourselves that are more stable in the markets we go to.
Gary, obviously there's a political implication of this as well. Countries aren't real pleased with a negative cash flow. A negative investment outcome.
Well, while that money is leaving, yeah, the ECB is plenty ready to pick that up. Yeah, so it's in net, there's actually negative net euro bond supply going on in the euro area because the ECB is swallowing up more than what's being issued. So it's these investors are being displaced. It's not so much a capital flight. They just have to leave. There's nowhere for them to put that dollar other than in equity. So if they want to seek high-quality fixed income, they need to leave. It is where they're being forced to go.
Or they need to come to the United States.
Well, they need to go somewhere.
Just, it's not leaving one of those other euro countries because they're all in a negative, a lot of them are in the negative yield situation as well. Right?
Yeah, that's leaving the entire euro area as a whole. Could be from Austria.
Can't go to Japan, right?
So, they could if they'd like to, but yeah, we're probably not positing that.
So what of the strategy then to head off the deflationary spiral? I mean, that's the reason they're in the negative interest rate environment. Is it working, or does the fact that capital flee take that tool out of the toolbox? What's the consensus now that we've been living with this for 5 years?
The hope that they're trying to really accomplish is to spur growth and inflation through investment, and by having these negative rates and pushing people out of safe instruments because they're taking them out of the market, buying German bonds.
The theory is, you know, you're charging them to hold money in the bank, right? So you want it up, but if they're just simply taking their money out of one bank and putting it into a higher yielding bank in a different country, it's not necessarily achieving the desired results.
Without getting too deep, there's a nuance to that. Like in the euro area, this negative deposit rate affects a very small amount of money because excess deposits in terms of the entire debt landscape is very
somebody
small.
Somebody from Europe is in the back row.
So what's ending up happening is they're trying to spur people to taking meaningful investment into the economies that's going to earn a higher yield, pushing them out the risk spectrum, if you will, trying to spur bank lending that's meaningful and buying equipment and enhancing economic activity.
So is it working?
The numbers are not really indicating it yet. Negative interest rates are somewhat of a new policy tool. They've yet to really show themselves. Japan's probably the most far along the path of it's not. Their extreme experimentation is not really showing a lot of fruit. But it's hard to break that out and understand what other drivers are also impacting that economy negatively and say, geez, it's just this experimentation. There's obviously hundreds of factors, but it doesn't show signs of having an immense positive impact yet.
But we've seen the impact in our treasury markets at the 30-year and long-term rates where everyone has thought that they wouldn't rally, and they've rallied, right? So that money is going somewhere. It's coming
You're still in the Angela's.
Oh, sorry, Angela. All right. I'm ready for it.
And we're almost there. So what this
Actually, wait, was there a comment in the back before we move on? Or, yes? No? You could also just see it as a veiled currency devaluation of Europe. So, you know, they may be getting exactly what they want, which is a much lower euro, so they can spur economic activity. Beggar thy neighbor policy. Okay.
Well, it's interesting that our private equity partner that we considered today was pitching a European strategy, effectively pushing us out the risk curve into Europe as well. So it might not work for the European investors, but it's certainly helping us.
Right.
Okay.
What this chart is showing is net foreign purchases of U.S. treasuries. This is treasury supply data that just shows who is buying our debt from overseas. And real quickly, private and official. Private just means corporations, pension funds, insurance companies, asset managers. Officials generally mean central banks and also other government entities, but generally central banks. And you'll see a clear break of late. And what appears to be the trend in the case is these private flow inflows into treasuries are exactly that, if you will, German bund out, U.S. Treasury in trade. However, we're seeing the official flows going negative into U.S. treasuries. A lot of that is currency management. The dollars appreciate very strongly, and so many foreign emerging market countries that have a peg or a range around the dollar are needing to protect that, and also propping up budgets because commodity exporting countries have been hurt quite dramatically, and they used to be net buyers of treasuries, and now they're liquidating these treasuries to bolster their budget and continue what's going on in their countries. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Angela, and she's going to explain why these flows are different because they operate in different sectors of the curve, and then touch on the impacts here at Treasury.
All right, so the change in the source and direction of the flows is meaningful to the U.S. Typically, official institutions navigate the five-year and in space, while we see private investment flows favoring the intermediate to long end of the curve. And so if we look here on the slide, you can see that in the fall last year, official institutions faced challenges, and as a result, there was upward pressure on the front end of the curve. And this was an opportunity for the short-term fund to take advantage of. And the different ownership structures are also impacting the shape of the U.S. Treasury curve, which I think Tom touched on earlier just briefly. So on this slide, you can see that it's flatter than it was just a year ago. The front end is increasing in yield due to foreign selling pressure and monetary policy tightening, while we see the long end experiencing inflows, and that's keeping yields contained. So I guess, ultimately, what does this mean to us? The reshaping of the curve has large implications to U.S. fixed income risk and return dynamics. So going forward, we'll be monitoring the change in flows and investor behavior. And we expect to see heightened volatility somewhat similar to what we just saw in the fall. So with the expectation that risk will increase, we'll be watching for pockets of opportunities as they present themselves. And thank you for letting us come up here today, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Is there any evidence of pressure on the Fed from out of the country to keep the life rates low? And if never see an official recognition of that.
It's very hard in the political channels to ever see that, as you mentioned.
Right.
The IMF, Christine Lagarde, the chair, she has publicly put pressure on them several times to not, and a lot of that is fact, they're very sensitive to emerging market pressures because that's where they tend to look at the loan book. Mm-hmm. So they look at it economically and warn GE should help take it pretty slow because the dollar rallying and commodity prices declining is extremely harmful to those countries.
You know, this is super impressive. I mean, I love that you guys are thinking forward instead of just looking at results. So thank you. And yeah, it's kind of terrifying. When you look at the official part of this curve that's leaving us, the private flows versus official flows, do we know who's leaving? Is it Europeans? Is it China? Do we know?
We kind of have a clue. It's extremely hard, though. There's a lot of gamesmanship. The Caribbean banking centers in Belgium, for example, tend to be large holders of treasuries, and it's because other people don't want to hold it in their name. So if China holds it in country and clears it to their borders, then it's pretty clear what's going on. But you see China's reserves falling pretty rapidly. You see a lot of volatility in Belgium. So there's speculation that's them. We don't frankly know. It's somewhat opaque. So we really can only see these very high-level trends and hope to gain little insights around the edges. But we really don't. It's very hard to tell.
So on this, what I've seen is this is helpful to split in the privates and the officials. But what I've seen in the 30-year Treasury market is that despite expectations that rates will go up, they've remained flat. So even though there's a split here, the net effect probably is slightly more money going into 30-year Treasuries. What's your take on that? Because we've been watching the 30-year Treasury very closely. Everyone except for the Treasury, 30-year Treasury investors have expected that rate to go up, but it hasn't. It's stayed flat, and the only way it can stay flat is if there are inflows there. So what are your thoughts about how this will change your behavior? Sure. Are you investing in 30-year Treasuries?
Well, clearly we just recently at the pension fund level made a push out into more advanced duration Treasuries.
Past 10 years, or what's advanced duration like?
The intermediate Treasury curve, Tom, is it 5.5 years?
Yeah.
Okay.
Of duration.
So it's across the curve, so it does include 30-year Treasuries.
Yep.
And some cash. Okay.
But really what... And why we brought this chart up and had to bring the mention of private official flows is, again, if you think about the private investors that are coming into the U.S., they're much like us, insurance companies, asset managers. They want the hedge, too. And that's duration. That's not a two-year treasury. That's more of a currency management central bank activity engaging. So, yeah, you're right. We're currently, what we believe we're seeing is that these private inflows are coming in and impacting, as Angela said, the intermediate to long-term portion of the curve because, again, they're seeking duration and yield. Not just currency exposure, a parking lot, if you will, for U.S. dollars.
So they're buyers of the long-term risk, and so we're willing to be with them in the buyer lot and stay away from the renters that may...
Well, and that's the fear, easy come, easy go, just as these charts have quickly diverged because of these monetary policy things, a spark of inflation here in the U.S. or a complete change in dynamics that caused these things to change, the outflows could be easy go as well, and that's why we're on guard for the volatility element is... it's fickle. Currencies, commodities, and a relative divergent central bank policy and economic outcomes drive these flows, and it can happen very quickly. And we don't really understand the underpinnings. We're just trying to monitor what we can to hopefully not be the last out, right?
Janet?
Yeah, just one extra point on that demand, because I think they did a really great job of describing the different supply-demand characteristics around different points in the curve. One other sort of demand issue on the longer end of the curve are U.S. corporate pensions and insurance companies that are hedging long-dated liabilities because corporate pensions, for the most part, have closed and are doing LDI. So they need long-term. So there's been very little supply and a lot of demand in the U.S. even for those longer-dated treasuries. So I think that's also had that dampening effect in addition to having these foreign flows. So there's a lot going on the longer end of the curve that's just keeping that long end down.
Wow. Garrett's wearing a bow tie today, so let's at least...
Yeah.
Did you tie it yourself?
I did.
Very well done. Nice.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Wow.
Okay. Any other comments from staff? Share your comments. Okay. Any public comment? Okay. Will you come up and introduce yourself? And
good afternoon. My name is Sharon Maxwell, and I just want to say thank you to the OIC, the council. I've been coming to the meetings for the last 3 months, and from my observation, I just wanted to make a comment and really kind of give a little bit of a testimonial of local and investment and how people like myself that are native, lived in Oregon for almost 52 years, am a businesswoman, a general contractor for the last 15 years, and as I see in the analysis, and I want to make recommendations and some requests, because there is a negative balance here in Oregon. I see a lot of investment going outside of Oregon and outside of the U.S., and the people here in this state are suffering. And so I would like to see the council take a better look at how the investment is done. When I look in this room and I see that there are a lack of people of color, it shows that there's no inclusion or equity. And part of my testimony is that in 1993, I live in Northeast Portland. I lived on Crack Alley. I seen my community destroyed. I seen the people. And this is like emotional for me, because when I come here and I see the dollars that could have helped save lives, 1,200 people murdered, families destroyed, a community destroyed, and now I see investment coming to the community and the existing residents not even benefit. That's a travesty as an Oregonian, and to see Oregonian dollars going outside of the state. It's not okay. We need to invest locally. When I see some of the people in this room, I see conflict of interest. The iceberg is that you need to reevaluate how this council, how these investments are handled, how they operate. You're missing some ingredients that I think will help in the future, because like we've been hearing today, some hard times are coming. I'm here because in 2005, I actually had a vision. The Port of Portland was getting ready to dredge the Columbia River. They made some miscalculations on that. Go back, look at the seeds of your investment and where they've been planted. Review it and recognize you have to include communities of color. That is the ingredient that will, there are trillions of dollars. When you invest in human capital, you actually get a return. How do I know that? Because I'm a product of that. In 1993, I recognized that if my community was going to turn around, it was going to take people like myself that live right there. I recognized that. I went to Portland Community College. Senator Margaret Carter, Senator Gordon Smith brought the construction trades program to the PCC Cascade campus. I said, let me go up there and see about the construction trades. I said, how are we going to rebuild this community? We have to do that. I became a carpenter, an apprentice. I went through the construction trades program. I became a carpenter and a sprinkler fitter. My first job was the Rose Quarter. I got to see a huge project go forth, and I recognized the opportunity. I had a vision and I had a plan to make sure that the people in my community had opportunity to get jobs, to get living wages, and to be a part of the rebuilding. But we never really got to see that because investment was not invested in that community. That community was allowed to be destroyed. And now people come in and own it and take over it, and all of the residents displace. Unacceptable. As we go forward as a nation, that's the political backdrop. We have to invest in the people of the United States of America. When I recognized on this past Monday, I went to the memorial celebration of Vanport, and Henry Kaiser's grandson was there. He spoke, and he had some quotes from his grandfather. And it was during the wartime that Vanport, the city of Vanport, was built in 110 days. The investment for 10,000 housing units, 110 days. Unimaginable. But that was people coming together, making an investment. That was for war. But what about in times of peace? What can we do when we work together and invest in people? When people have the ability to get an education, the ability to contribute, their families are strong, That's what Oregon should be about. That's what Oregon dollars should be about. That's what this council should be about. That's what leaders do. They have a vision to make sure that people's lives are impacted and that the next generation is inspired to the unimaginable, ingenuity and innovation. That's what we're looking for out of this council and the investments, not buying hedge funds, destroying neighborhoods because you're giving out bad loans that you know people are not going to be able to repay. They lose their homes. I have never in my life seen tents, Portland, Oregon, lined up on the streets, people homeless. That is so despicable. That should not even be said in this state. So when we're doing investments, take the time. Go back. You need to go back and look at the investments that have already been done because that's where your problems are going to be. So going forward, you have an opportunity to self-correct. And that self-correct is investment in human capital, investment in the local economy, help the community grow and thrive, and people will recognize that. And just like the flood of 1996, what did people do? People showed up to build that wall along that Willamette River so that those flood waters would not go over into downtown Portland. I have an opportunity right now where I'm at in some transition. I drive for Lyft. And as I drive for Lyft, you know where I go? Into the West Hills. I go to Forest Heights. I go up to Southwest Portland. I go to where all the money is. People who have money. Discretionary money. Money to go out to dinner. Money to do nice things. Money to go on vacations. But where I live, there's no discretionary money because there's no investment. People are starving. People are living on from paycheck to paycheck when we need to make sure that people have the right investments so that they can get the right type of jobs. When I go into, I'm a success coach as well, and I had the opportunity to work for Inside Track. And when I went into the PGE building this past fall and I looked in the elevator, it was like nobody but me, a person of color, and people looking as though, in downtown Portland, hardly any people of color. The investment has to come from businesses, corporations to invest in people of color. That's the missing ingredient. When it comes to investment, that's where in hard times, that's where you're going to find the ingredients. So thank you for allowing me to make a comment. I wanted to keep it real 100%. I wanted to share my story because that's what I've lived. And the fact that as a general contractor, to secure a $60 million project as a black female and not be able to go into a bank and get a line of credit is a travesty.
Thank you. Okay, we have just a couple more minutes of public comment.
Hello, my name is Michael Panesci. I work with Unite here. Bring everybody up at once.
Michael, can you speak into the microphone just a little bit more?
Yeah.
Thanks.
So I'm here to talk about the Palms in Las Vegas, which is owned by TPG and Leonard Green, both significant partners for the OIC. In a moment, you will hear from Larry Holt, who is a worker at the Palms Casino, and Dr. Sylvester Rogers of the Greater Mount Sinai Missionary Baptist Church in Las Vegas. You have heard from Palms workers in the past year about their efforts to secure a fair process to choose whether to unionize. 2 weeks ago, it was announced that the Palms is set to be sold. The Las Vegas Review-Journal reported, quote, "There is no indication whether Palms employees would have to reapply for jobs when the transaction closes," end quote. We urge TPG and Leonard Green to resolve the labor dispute before ownership change. Workers deserve labor peace and a binding commitment that they will not lose their jobs. In fact, labor peace is the standard in Las Vegas. Dozens of casinos have agreed to a fair process for tens of thousands of workers there. Worker retention is also the standard in ownership transitions. For example, Blackstone retained all the workers without making them reapply when it took over the Cosmopolitan in 2014. We ask that Oregon urge TPG and Leonard Green to commit to labor peace and worker retention at the Palms. And thank you for your time today, and Dr. Sylvester Rogers.
I'll get out of your way, please.
Good evening to the council. I'm Dr. F.S. Rogers, as he stated, pastor of the Greater Mount Sinai Missionary Recruiting Ministries, and I've been resident of Clark County 55 years. Not only that, but as a family, husband, married 55 years, 2 months, and 25 days. And to me, as I'm here today, because of the situation, I thank God for the young lady that spoke earlier, and we have those same problems in Las Vegas. But we're here today to, from the clergy perspective, that we as clergy, we as have parishioners in our congregation, some of y'all does not know the actual facts of how these workers are treated, how they are disjointed, how families are dismantled because of when new owners take over, or whatever the case may be, how they are mistreated. And I see the facts of life. The 6th of this month, I'll be 76 years old. And seeing things from the South, I'm from the South, I'm from a family of 25 brothers and sisters, how my father, how he labored to make sure that we was educated. He made sure what we had to do as men, as our daughters had to do as daughters. And to see family, I can understand some men why they get so tied up and do stupid things, I would say. They're not stupid, but they're things to protect, take care of that family. Because when they're dismantled and they are men, they are fathers, they are want to take care of their families, but when disruption comes, they have no other choice but try to do what they need to do to take care of their families. As I said earlier, in the labor of this hotel, we're concerned about, hope that this now will be a dismantle situation. Those workers who are there, make sure that they are secure in their jobs. That's unionized, they should be have the opportunity is to be unionized and the unions to work with the situation and what they are in. I don't know how your structure, how your lives, or your jobs and situation, but what if your job that you have now, if the owner come in and say, well, today is your last day, what default would that be in your life? What would your mind start thinking? What would you do at that moment? How would you feel at that moment? We have billionaires, trillionaires, who have families. Their families will take care well. But these workers does not have that kind of finance. Say, for instance, I'm going to use this example, that a millionaire has 3 children, and he sent them to private high schools. It's not college yet. Private high private schools. Said, maybe you might spend $50,000 a year on each student. That's $150,000 that he just spent on a high school. Here, these families cannot even make $100,000 a year for the family structure itself. It's not dealing with another situation. They may have yachts. They may have 5 or 6 other homes somewhere in other cities that they can go and lay out and relax. Think about these families. Think about these, the husband, the wife, the children, how these men, how these families, and now we have more single parents, most women's, that is raising their children. And I've looked at the panel, and that's something unusual. I want to commend these 6 men, not against the 3 ladies that's here. But usually to see a panel, and most are women, and not men. But today I see the quorum of six men and three women. But in the process of that, we need to look at the outcome of our parishioners from a pastor perspective in a community, in the past 33 years in that city, knowing the concept of people and lives, how they come here. I had a man call me yesterday, just while I was getting ready for Pat to come here. The pastor called and said, I need a job. And why a lot of people cannot get a job? And we look at the structure, how marijuana is being unexplored, how they need to grow it and sell it. And most of our young people, she said, men of color, are incarcerated because they were trying to survive. They need a job. They couldn't get it. So they use all the measurement they had in order to what? To try to make ends meet or get something because to take care of their family. So now they're being legalized and raised. But what about those young men that have been incarcerated and now they are felonies and cannot come out into the community and restructure themselves? What happened to those young men? So we need to revamp. We need to go back to the drawing board. And she said, and restructure. Look at the bottom part. Why did this happen? We don't look at the reason why this happened. Some of us know why it happened, but we're not concerned about why it happened that way. And I thank you for listening at this portion of this segment. While we're here, I travel this distance because I love the people. Not only one people, but all people. And in Matthew, the 22nd chapter, verse 34 through verse 35. Read it. Y'all are believers, aren't you? Are y'all believers? You're believing something, I guess. But are you a true believer? And Jesus said it was a concept came to him. It was an entrapment. And we have a lot of that now, entrapment. People entrap people. And these were the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They came to Jesus and asked him a question. What is the greatest commandment? And he said to them, first love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, mind, soul, and strength. And the second is, love thy neighbor as thyself. And if we love our neighbor as ourselves, look at others as well as ourselves, he put others before himself. So that's what we need to look at. What I can do for to help someone else. Then if I help someone else, then he said, I'll hang on these two. That's all you need. You don't have to worry about the ten. If you do these two, love the Lord thy God with all heart, mind, soul, and strength, and thy neighbor and thyself, we wouldn't have the problem that we have today. May God bless you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good afternoon. My name is Larry Holt, and I'm a porter at the Palms. I'm one of the Palms' original employees. I've been there since the casino opened 15 years ago. I've worked in the hospitality industry for 25 years, including 10 years at a union hotel. I know what it's like to enjoy fair wages and good health insurance in a union job, which is why I'm here to speak for myself and the hundreds of other workers at the Palms Casino. We have been seeking for a process for a year, but instead Palms management has faced accusations of worker intimidation. The National Labor Relations Board issued complaint last October over allegations including unlawful surveillance, threats, and coercion. The Palms settled that complaint in December, but within weeks, workers filed additional charges of threats and surveillance, which were settled with the National Labor Relations Board last month. But the Palms still hasn't agreed to labor peace. We work hard every day. We are dedicated to our customers. We have worked to make the Palms successful and want a commitment that will keep our jobs, seniority, benefits through the change in owners. In other words, we are simply asking for TPG to uphold the standards set by the vast majority of Las Vegas casinos on the Strip and downtown. A fair process to choose whether to unionize and a commitment to worker retention. I hope that Oregon will tell TPG and Leonard Green, you want our jobs and our right to a fair process protected. And I thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other public comment? Okay. Meeting adjourned. I'm going to go to the next one.